Welcome to the West Elk Word. I'm Tony Todd, and today my guest is Wendy Vidlock. Wendy is an award-winning poet, author of several books of poetry, and has published in several well-known journals and magazines, including O Magazine, the Hudson Review, and the New York Times. She is also the Poet Laureate of Colorado's Western Slope. Wendy joins us today from her home in Palisade, Colorado. Wendy Vidlock, welcome.
Thanks, Tony.
Let's start with that lofty title, Poet Laureate. What is that?
Yeah, it's interesting, huh? I mean, I think in my case, I mean, everybody takes this role on in a different way. Kay Ryan, who was Poet Laureate of the United States, said that her job as Poet Laureate was to continue writing the best poems she could. Billy Collins said that his job was to put poetry into high schools. Everybody has a different kind of take on it. My take has been, let's put poetry in public spaces and let's integrate it with the other arts and with, you know, regular kind of human gatherings. Let's see what happens if we start meetings off with a poem and nobody has to discuss it or analyze it or you know, tear it apart to find out what it means, because, you know, a poem is like a song. It's going to mean something different to everybody. And if your first experience with a poem is in school and they're dissecting it, then you're probably not going to love it. Your first experience with music wasn't like that. Like, you got to just experience a song.
That's interesting that you say that, because later on I have a question queued up for you. We'll just go right to it now.
Okay.
About making poetry more accessible and feel less pretentious.
Yeah.
And that sounds like exactly what you just described.
The thing that people, I've really learned this the last, I don't know, over and over again for the past 10 or 15 years, is that one of the things that people hate more than anything is feeling stupid. If they think that a poem is a riddle or a puzzle that they're supposed to figure out, then they've just been taught wrong. Like, nobody feels that way about a movie or any of the other arts. It's only with poetry that there's this feeling that you're missing out on something. And so the first thing I say to anybody about poetry is, if you don't like a poem, turn the page. Like, you get to do that. You know, you're not going to watch a movie the whole way through on Netflix, you know, if you don't like it in the first 20 minutes. You have the option. So just because that doesn't mean that you don't like movies. It means you didn't like that movie. And the next one you might love. So same thing with a poem or a poet, you know, that you get to decide. It's not that there's this standard up here. And I think that's where poetry has become a little bit, how shall I say, obscure. A lot of what we call academic poetry is not very musical. And it's not telling a story, and it's not connecting us to the land or place. And I mean, I blame the New Yorker, but, you know, there are a whole lot of other sort of well-known journals too that, you know, for many years though, they were just publishing what sounded like gobbledygook to most of us.
I blame them for turning the American short story into a dark and foreboding place.
Right. Where's your humor? And where is your love of beauty and perspective? And yeah, it's definitely an uphill battle.
It's interesting that you say that. I was teaching some entry-level college English students for a while, and one of the things they said that they disliked about their high school English classes all the way back to elementary school was having to analyze everything, having to break it apart. And they never got to really enjoy the story. They never even remembered what the story was about. And isn't that really at the heart of everything we do?
I mean, Billy Collins said, try not to tie the poem to a chair and try to beat the meaning out of it. And he was speaking to English teachers. It's just, I mean, we've kind of put English teachers in that position, so I can't really blame them. It's more kind of the system, which is that's how it's going to appear on the test, those standardized tests, is what does this metaphor mean? What does this symbolize? Instead of looking at the poem as a whole and just going, well, what's your experience with that poem? Like, being able to write a paragraph on your experience with it is different from answering A, B, C, and just looking at it like it's an analytical math problem or something.
When you first discovered your own curiosity with words, can you tell us about that? When did you find your voice?
Well, I still haven't. I mean, I feel like it's a lifetime, like it's not just poets. So many of us struggle with voice, when to be quiet, when to speak up, when to speak with authority, when to speak with, you know, just a complete compassionate ear. The kids nowadays call it code switching. And I think it's something that is just a normal part of life. We speak a little differently with someone who's a poet. If I'm a poet, I'm going to speak differently to a poet who I know, you know, is working in the same genre and in the same kind of circles. And if I'm speaking with a fourth grader about poetry, it's going to be different. I'm going to talk to my mother differently about a movie I saw than I will with my husband. We all do it all the time. And it really just has to do with language. And so what I do, what I've really done is in the last few years in terms of voice and language is just to try to get us to understand that we don't just speak English. We speak raven. We speak cat. Some of us really don't speak cat. Some of us speak dog. We speak tree. Like there are many different languages that we can speak. And so if we think of it like that, then we don't feel like we're putting on a false hat when we do a little bit of a shift when we're talking with people, particularly about something like poetry, which can add so much to our lives. And I hate to talk about poetry as though it were broccoli and it's good for you, but it's such a fabulous companion. So what happened with me, I was really quiet as a child. So being quiet turned me into a reader, and being quiet allowed me to hear sort of the rhythms of language. I can remember like hearing grown-ups talking when I was in my bedroom and just knowing what was being said just by the tone and by the rhythm and the pace. And so before I was paying attention to what was being said, I was paying attention to how it was being said. And I think that that's the most important thing in all of our relationships is not, I mean, what we say really matters, but how we say it, super important.
Super important. And I think everybody's able to relate to that because everybody said something that they meant to say, but they didn't mean to say it that way.
I mean, we all do. We all put our foot in our mouths and then we're kind of left with like stewing over it. And so just being mindful about language changes everything about the way we move in the world.
Can you describe your creative process? Is there a consistency to it or does it?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty. I mean, I also write prose, and writing prose feels very different. So with prose, I have to just you got to get your bum in the seat and start writing. With poems, I tend to need to be ambushed. My old friend Jack used to say, I got ambushed this morning, you know, and it just happens. And most poets report suddenly, you know, usually when we're moving, you know, or rowing, or, you know, there's some kind of movement involved. People think that poetry is very cerebral. It's actually super, super physical. Like our physiology is so involved. This is why we say a poem moves us or it's a moving poem. We're moved to tears. That's a physical response. Emily Dickinson said the hair on the back of her neck stands up. That's a physical response. We can laugh. That's a physical response. So a lot of times poets will know that if they're stuck in their heads, they can't really write an effective, meaningful poem that has some kind of life, some kind of vital energy in it. Whereas if we sit down and just we have something on our minds and we've got an opinion, that poem is going to kind of arrive dead on arrival. Like it's just not going to have that life force. But if we just let something hit us, and usually with me, it's a phrase or a rhythm, and it's usually a phrase that I've read or overheard. And then I go, why is that so interesting to me? And then I kind of want to explore it. And then the poem takes me down a path. So really, there's this thing just about getting out of the way because language, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. Language knows better than we do. We think we know stuff that we don't know.
I've had this experience myself, and I've talked to many fiction writers who will tell you that when they're in the zone, when the story is happening, it's happening. You're not creating it. I've heard writers say that they didn't know the character was going to do something or say something or go somewhere. Mm-hmm. It just happened. And that's the same idea, right?
I mean, it's the beauty of the arts is that we get to be surprised. And it's one of the reasons I kind of proselytize about the arts so much, because it seems like if you don't get to experience that, where you're so present and yet not trying to control everything, but somehow something beautiful is being made, something is happening, and it's a mystery to all of us. None of us really understand this thing. Athletes talk about it too, that they've practiced something enough that they can kind of let go once they're in the game. And it can happen with yoga, it can happen with music, being in that zone. I think it's the best thing we humans can do.
How would you describe, if you can, your style of poetry?
Well, it's interesting because poetry, like all the arts, likes to have its categories. And so there's your pastoral poets and your narrative poets and your formal poets and your free verse poets and your confessionals and all of that. And I've always been really hard pressed to sort of put myself down into one of those categories. That I think that probably the thing that would best describe what I do, both in prose and in verse, is I'm a poet of place. I'm very much a Colorado, Western Colorado writer. Almost all of my metaphors come from the land around me. I grew up in Tucson, the Sonoran Desert, so the desert is in my blood. So I speak the language of the land. And then I have a leaning towards what they call formal verse, but formal poetry isn't exactly what I do either. I'm more formal-ish. I like those sort of liminal spaces because it allows us to have. So what form does is it allows us to have something to get out of our own heads. Sort of like it allows us to get in the zone. So that if you've read enough sonnets, you kind of know what iambic pentameter is like, so that you're not trying to force a da 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 da. You're not forcing that, but that you're kind of aware that there are these guidelines, so that you have to work a little harder to come up with a different word or a different phrase or a different metaphor. And especially with difficult subjects, I find adding that little or allowing that sort of formal element to inform. And also, there's no getting away from it. We are human. We live in these bodies. There's really no such thing as a formless piece of art.
It is the form that helps us know that it exists and is there, right?
Not what a poem means, but how a poem means really seems to say it. That's a Howard Nemiroff quote.
Is there such a thing as a perfect poem?
I mean, there are poems that I marvel at every single, like Richard Wilbur has a poem called Hamlyn Brook. And the last lines are so he's describing just getting a drink from a brook. And the whole poem, I think, is one sentence. The syntax is beautiful. It's just absolutely exquisite. And then the last line is, "Joy's trick is to supply dry lips with what can slake, but never, leaving you with an ache nothing can satisfy." And that's really how a beautiful poem works, is that you're just sort of turned on to this beauty, this exquisiteness. And what happens is that then you want more. So you're not slaked. It's not like, oh, I'm satisfied. You always want more. And in my view, that is one of the most perfect poems in the English language. Emily's Because I Could Not Stop for Death, I think, is a perfect poem. But a lot of poets say there's no such thing as a perfect poem, and that a poem is never finished, it's only abandoned. And every poem I've ever published, I look at it later and go, "Ooh, I could have done it. They should have done this, or could have got rid of that comma."
I have a friend named Anne Kasten who's a brilliant poet, and she was at a reading one time, reading from a book she had published 20 years earlier. And as she was reading it, decided there was a better word that she could have used. So afterward, at the signing, she went to that page and crossed it out and wrote in the new word for everybody who she signed that book for, which I thought was brilliant.
Well, we all edit our work in the moment. Auden famously had a line in the poem September 1941, which became kind of an anthem after the Twin Towers came down. And so it's a really powerful, longer poem. And he has this line in it, "We must love one another or die." And he refused to ever have it published like that again because he changed it to, "We must love one another and die." And he made a lot of people very upset. I mean, he just could not stand it. And it was just the difference between and or.
If you are just joining us here today on The West Elk Word, I'm Tony Todd, and my guest is Wendy Vidalock, Poet Laureate for the Western Slope of Colorado. Would you like to read one for us?
I almost have this by heart, but I don't trust myself to have it by heart, so. So it's called deconstruction, which is funny because that's what they do with what we were talking about at the top of the show. It's teachers deconstruct poems. So I'm always kind of tweaking and kind of poking fun at the academy, even though I love academia because they keep things going. Like without them, what would happen? We need that. Poetry is a big tent. The chickadee is all about truth. The finch is a token. The albatross is always an omen. The kestrel is mental. The goose is quest. The need for speed is given the peregrine, and the dove has been blessed with the feminine. The quail is word and culpability. The crane is the dean of poetry. The swift is the means to agility. The waxwing is civility. The sparrow, a nod to working class nobility. The puffin's the brother of laughter and prayer, the starling, the student of Baudelaire. The mockingbird is the sound of redress, the grackle, the uncle of excess. The flicker is rhythm, the ostrich is earth, the bluebird, a simple symbol of mirth. The oriole is the fresh start, the magpie, prince of the dark arts. The swallow is home and protection. The vulture, the priest of purification. The heron, a font of self-reflection. The pheasant is sex. The chicken is egg. The eagle is free. The canary, the bringer of ecstasy. The martin is peace. The stork is release. The swan is the mother of cool discretion. The loon is the watery voice of the moon. The owl is the keeper of secrets and grief and fresh fallen snow. And the crow has the bones of the ancestral soul.
Ooh.
Thank
I love that.
you.
How does a poem like that start? You mentioned you are an artist of the land,
Yeah.
or in this case, the sky to some extent.
Right. Right.
How does a spark come to you for a poem like that?
You know, the heron is a font of self-reflection. There was a heron that was every day on my way home, I would stop and watch this heron, and the way he would just sit there and wait and wait. And so I just had this, that the heron is a font of self-reflection was just in my head. And I was like, I can play with that. And then I went, well, what's the sparrow? Oh, well, the sparrow is kind of like working class. You know, like they're everywhere, they're doing a lot of work, and nobody really pays attention to them. Hey, working class, you know. And so I just started, once I had the sparrow after the heron, then I just started going, oh, another list poem. And I love lists, and poets love lists because they become litanies. And then changing the sort of syntax or the grammar of it becomes the great moment in the poem where things shift so that the surprise starts to feel like, oh, we're talking about human characteristics here and archetypes and how we humans anthropomorphize things. And you know, so then it became almost like a reflection on, you know, human behavior too.
You're also a visual artist.
Yes, I am.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? And also, is there a similarity or something that connects your word art with your visual art?
Such a great question. I always think of Joni Mitchell, who was a painter and a songwriter and a poet. She always thought of herself as a painter first, believe it or not. But she called it crop rotation. And it really, it just, that is so, it just feels so organic. Like you're using up all the nutrients in language. And there are times, you know, when the poet just needs to be quiet. It's really a big part of being a writer is just paying attention and quietly listening, and if you also teach, then you find yourself talking a little bit too much. So the painting is great for me, just getting kind of revitalizing the land for language to uprise in a new way. And then I have found in recent years it's a lot of fun to play with an image and then put a line of poetry. Our poet laureate of Colorado, Andrea Gibson. This is another example of a great, you know, different schools, different kind of schools, and she's really a spoken word poet. And I've never really loved it until her. She really knows how to write for the page and the stage, which is unusual because she's using a lot of poetic devices, and she's a maestra of the metaphor. And I, you know, it's kind of like this is another thing that poetry always teaches you is that you don't know what you like. If you keep your mind open, you're going to surprise yourself.
Can you send us one more poem?
How, this is another little list. How you might approach a foal. Like a lagoon. Like a canoe. Like you are part earth and part moon. Like a bloom, like deja vu, like you had never been to the brink or the Louvre, like straw, like air, like your mother had just this morning braided a dream into your hair, like you have nothing to do, like you had never heard a sermon or a scathing word. Like a fool, like a pearl, like you are new to the world.
I love that.
Thank you so much. Very sound driven, you know, that language seems to know. I would never, you know, I had an experience, the horse next door was a little bit, you know, shy with me when we first moved in. And I thought, well, I wonder what she was like when she was a foal and the first person approached her. So that's how my title informed the whole poem, How You Might Approach a Foal. And I know that horses are really sensitive to our energy. If we're a little bit neurotic or a little bit nervous or in a rush, they're just gonna mirror whatever you're feeling. And so in this way, poems really, you know, inform our lives. Like this poem taught me, oh yeah, never go rushing up to that horse.
What I love about that poem is that those likes are not what you would traditionally describe as likes, and yet they work so well. There's something so subtle and soft about each one of those that inform how a person would be in that situation.
And this
And
is again, this is
yeah.
the language showing us. Like all I had was a title, How You Might Approach a Foal. And then I just thought, well, watery. And then like a lagoon. A lagoon. Wow, I live in the desert. Okay. Like a lagoon. It's just there. You come across it. And you would enter it like it was something sacred.
What would you say, Wendy, to those out there who are, I don't know, reticent, a little skeptical, a little uncomfortable with the idea of maybe going to a poetry reading or even attempting to write a poem themselves?
Well, the arts will change your life. I mean, it changes everybody that I know in the arts has said that the arts have changed their lives. And those that aren't in the arts, I want to say, you must change your life. All you need is a little bit of the arts. Poetry is so meaningful that people tell us all the time that poems have changed their lives. We hear this all the time. And the idea is that If you are seeking meaning, which most people are, poetry is your best open door, and the door is open. And that if you just go to a reading, or you pick up an anthology, or you if you found a poem that you didn't hate, and you decide, oh, maybe I'll look up that, author. Most of us have books of poems on the shelves. So I love this idea of just doing things at random. So if you go into a bookstore and pick up a book and poems in the poetry section and you just open it at random, then you might find that the poem didn't speak to you, but you might find that it did. And then you start to go, oh, this is how the arts work. Like you just kind of put it in their hands. Like I'll just go read a poem every day, just one. There are also a whole bunch of publications that will send you a poem in the mail, in email every day. I find that's not my best way. I like to have a book. But if you don't, if you respond to things online or on email, subscribe to, Rattle or Poetry Magazine, or our friend Rosemary Watola-Tromer puts out a poem every day, so that people are receiving and they don't, I just did a TED talk a couple months ago, and the whole central sort of message was that if you don't pause, you can't receive the offering. And the offerings are all around us. It's the pause that the arts allow us, that allows us to understand that we actually have an inner life. And it wants to be nurtured.
Excellent. Well, Wendy Vidlock, thank you so much for joining me today on the
It
West
was a
Elk
pleasure,
Corner.
Tony. Thank you so much for the invitation.
That's it for this edition of the West Elk Word. You can catch up with our latest episodes at kbut.org. Thanks for joining us today. See you next time. Support for KBUT comes from Towny Books and Rumors Coffee and Tea House, serving locally roasted coffee and fine loose leaf teas. Towny Books stocks new books for children and adults and can special order anything. Drink coffee, read books, fight evil.